This is The Takeaway for Thursday, January 26th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. We thank you so much for listening. National security and immigration are President Trump's focus this week. At the Department of Homeland Security Wednesday, he reiterated his campaign promise to act immediately through executive action. At DHS, he stated that his order
ends the policy of catch and release at the border, requires other countries to take back their criminals. They will take them back. Cracks down on sanctuary cities.
And, of course, start that wall, the promised border wall with Mexico. The president also wants to hire 5,000 more Border Patrol officers. And despite the fanfare of these announcements, he's going to need Congress to go along to get most of these policies enacted. But today, Donald Trump wields his pen and his megaphone in a far more direct way, issuing an executive order blocking refugees fleeing war and persecution from entering the United States for 4 months and banning refugees from Syria entirely. In total, the order cuts the number of refugees allowed in the U.S. from 110,000 down to 50,000. And in addition, another order banning anyone from coming to the United States from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, or Yemen. Now, orders like these can seem like political abstractions, and there are politics involved, to be sure, but they're not abstract for many people hoping to come to the United States or people living here now.
My name is Ala Majid. I was born and raised in Iraq. I am a U.S. citizen from New York City.
Ala fled persecution in Iraq and came to the U.S. as a refugee. And today she's working to help other refugees escape, like she did, and to bring their families with them, something that took a long time to do.
In Iraq, I worked as a journalist and a translator from 2003 until 2005. And then I had to flee the country, leaving my family, including my two children, behind. Went to Jordan. I was in Jordan for a year and a half before I was able to come to the U.S. in 2007. In 2009, I was able to bring my two children to join me, so I saw them for the first time in 4 years, and I was so grateful that I was able to bring them to be and live in safety in America. In 2010, I decided it was time for me to try and help my family who were being persecuted in Iraq to try and help them apply for resettlement in the U.S. So I started the process in 2010 and was only able to help them actually be in America at the end of 2015. That's when they arrived in the U.S. It was in 2015. In the meantime, my father was sick with cancer, and he wasn't getting the right treatment in Iraq. I had missed them. It had been years since I left Iraq, and I really wanted him to be in America to get the right treatment. He died in 2014. So that means that it took my family actually 5 years to get to the U.S. However, my two nephews, who are the children of my sister, she wasn't able to bring her two children. So they are in Iraq right now. And when I heard of the executive order in the past couple of days, it's just like it really tore my heart apart, because I thought, you know, my nephews, they are 5 and 6 years old, and they really should be in safety and they should be with their mother. But we don't really know what this will mean for the application to bring my two nephews to the U.S. All I know is that my sister hasn't asked me yet, and I really don't know what I will tell her.
Ala says she wants the same opportunity for others that she had when she came to this country.
I myself was born and raised as a Muslim, but I go to church on Sundays. I have a giant, really nice Christmas tree every year for the whole month of December. I get scared from terrorists. I will defend my country, America, in any way possible. I will definitely report any suspicious actions that I see or hear of. On the other hand, I myself am a very hard worker. I've never asked for any government assistance in the U.S. I pay my mortgage on time every month, pay my taxes. I work really hard. I volunteer. This is exactly, in my opinion, what America is about. It was already since the beginning built on people who fled different types of persecutions, including religious persecution. And so it is, you know, the place where everyone looks for, and I would love for everyone in this world who is qualified and being persecuted for any reason to be able to come to a place like America and enjoy what I am enjoying and just be part of building this great country.
That was Alaa Majeed sharing her story with us. She's a former Iraqi journalist and translator who fled Iraq in 2005 and came to the U.S. in 2007. With me now here in the studio is Mark Doss. He's well acquainted with stories like Alaa's, as well as those that don't have such a happy ending. Mark Doss is supervising attorney at the International Refugee Assistance Project at the Urban Justice Center. And also on the line is Trita Parsi, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. He's also author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Mark, let me start with you because you can answer some of the lawyer questions about these executive orders. What do they say as it relates to the law? Who can come now and who can't?
So this proposed executive order is a temporary suspension of the U.S. refugee admissions program. So what it's saying is for the next 120 days, no refugees can come to the United States. It's additionally preventing certain immigrant and non-immigrant visa holders from a host of countries from entering the United States for the next 30 days.
And what have your clients, the people who you represent, refugees and would-be refugees, been saying to you over the last day? What are you hearing?
I've been getting frantic calls. This is utterly devastating for them. These are individuals who have gone through unimaginable persecution, unimaginable trauma, who have been waiting for years through the security check process, multiple interviews, biometrics, everything to come to the United States. Some of them with travel dates next week and are now not going to be allowed into the country. This was their lifeline.
And what will some of those people do? Stay in limbo, stay in their countries?
Many of them have no options, besides trying to take a boat. I mean, this is why we see such a huge migration crisis to Europe, because there are limited resettlement slots. Now when the United States shuts down its resettlement program, there are no other options.
I want to bring in now Trita Parsi, who's founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, also author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Trita Parsi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you're an expert on the visa program as well, and visitors, travelers from Iran as well as six other countries have been banned temporarily under the executive order from President Trump. Is there a security risk in the visa program more broadly? Do you see any merit to slowing down or stopping here, even temporarily?
Well, the principle that the new executive order is based on is the idea that you actually can add security by imposing a blanket ban based on national origin. Now, if we just for a second assume that that's a valid principle, I don't, but let's assume it is, then it's still extremely ineffective and frankly counterproductive, because none of the major terrorist attacks in the United States since 9/11 have been committed by citizens or visa holders from these countries that have now been included.
So we should reiterate, Mark Doss, two groups of people in these executive orders, refugees and then visa holders from these seven countries that were designated. Give us a sense of who these refugees are and what types of situations are they facing? Because many Americans don't have a clear sense of what it means to be a refugee now.
Absolutely. We have the greatest refugee crisis since World War II, where we have over 60 million people who have been forcibly displaced from their homes. And these are people who have not chosen to leave their homes. These are people who have been persecuted for their race, their religion, their political opinion, for a whole host of reasons. And they have been facing unimaginable, devastating trauma and persecution. People who have been raped, have lost their loved ones. The refugee program allows people to start over, start a new life. And to shut it down is extremely irresponsible. It's devastating on their lives and puts that many more people in active danger.
Trita, what's the message that you hear here at home in the United States. Islamophobia is a fact of life in this country. In many ways, it was amplified during the election. We all know that. What is the tacit message here in this policy? I mean, on the one hand, it's not a Muslim ban legally, technically, because countries have been identified, not people. But is that the message that you're hearing?
Well, in reality, it ends up being a Muslim ban because all of these countries are majority Muslim countries. And this is just adding further to an atmosphere with Islamophobia that has been not only largely created, but also tremendously fueled ever since the Republican primaries, in which a lot of these rather bigoted views got center stage in the American discourse.
And so then what's next for you, Trita Parsi? There are 4 years in this presidency, of course, and executive orders, the president has the power to issue them when it comes to immigration. What's next for you?
Well, we're working in a coalition of organizations that are going to be challenging this, and we're going to mount a congressional challenge to this as well, and propose much better ideas of how security can be enhanced without creating these type of divisions and actually targeting the real problem instead of creating an atmosphere of fear and using that to pass new immigration laws that actually make no sense.
Mark Doss, you have to leave here today. You're going to go to your office. I know you're going to get on your phone and on your email to a lot of worried people, probably overseas, waiting to come here. What are you going to tell them?
We're going to absolutely be fighting for them. We're going to be reassuring them. We're going to be looking for other options, other countries that might be friendlier and accepting of refugees and welcoming refugees.
What about that? What are the legal options or the rerouting options for people right now?
Many people don't understand, but the refugee process is not just someone just choosing to fly over to the United States. It is years of interviews and security checks, and the first layer of that process is being determined by the United Nations Refugee Agency that you are indeed a refugee. And the United Nations can refer refugees for different resettlement countries. So the U.S. takes the most number of refugees, but there are a handful of other countries that accept refugees, such as Canada, Australia, countries in Europe. And so we'll be looking into options for those countries to take our clients.
Mark Doss is supervising attorney at the International Refugee Assistance Project at the Urban Justice Center. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Trita Parsi, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Trita Parsi is founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. He's also author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. We here at The Takeaway are fresh off three fantastic days broadcasting from Oklahoma City, where we heard from a lot of local residents and teachers, politicians, activists about the future of their city and state. Oklahoma also has the second largest Native American population in the country, second only to California. There are over 330,000 Native Americans in Oklahoma, with 38 federally recognized tribes. Those large numbers have not always translated to political power in the state, however, where fights for oil and water have been largely dominated by business or U.S. government interests, often at the expense of tribes. But some of the larger tribes in Oklahoma are getting more prosperous now, and that means the power dynamic might be starting to shift. John Hockenberry sat down with Logan Layden earlier this week at KOSU in Oklahoma City. Logan is a reporter with State Impact Oklahoma, and they talked about how Native American tribes are getting their voices and their interests heard.
Well, I've seen it in my own lifetime. I'm 32 years old, and whenever I was a little kid, they had a lot less power than they did today. Today, the tribes in Oklahoma, particularly the Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Osage, these larger tribes are a real political force. And that has come about for a few reasons. I think the advent of casino gambling here in Oklahoma had a lot to do with it. Certainly, the tribes have a lot more money than they used to because of that, but also some pretty strong leadership in the tribes themselves. And so they've grown in my own lifetime to be a real political force that you don't want to cross here in Oklahoma, whereas in the past, obviously, they were sort of rolled over by both the federal and the state government and not really given a lot of thought to.
So 30 years ago, there was this kind of chaotic relationship between the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs and whatever was going on the reservations or other lands. But casino gambling and the leadership that that wealth has produced has completely changed things. These are autonomous entities, and they have political missions of their own.
That's absolutely right. The Choctaw and Chickasaw Nations in southeast Oklahoma, throughout the history of the state, that part of the state has been in very deep poverty. There's not a lot of jobs, not a whole lot of resources other than the water that's there, and it used to be mining and logging. But we've seen the tribes now become one of the biggest employers in that part of the state. They are very autonomous. They provide a lot of jobs, and that's created a lot of goodwill amongst the tribe members. You can talk, you know, by talking to members of the nations, you can just tell the kind of pride that they have now, whereas 20 or 30 years ago, they just weren't the same sort of political force. Today, they build roads. They have a chocolate factory. They obviously, in the tribal water fight that we had here in southeast Oklahoma that I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, decades ago, the state government would have given not a second thought to what the tribes thought about wanting to take water from that part of the state. But more recently, you just don't want to cross them. That's bad for you politically if you have the tribes against you.
Is there a partnership being born here in the sense that tribes are inclined to work with civic authorities like the city of Oklahoma City and produce a new kind of environmental regulations that shares land and water and mineral rights in a way that the federal government maybe should look at as a model?
Maybe so. This is a few years ago. Oklahoma City, where we're at right now here in the metro, they have a need for water in the future. They see that they're a growing city. They're going to need other sources of water. Well, they own water rights to some of the lakes in southeast Oklahoma in the Choctaw and Chickasaw Nations. And so the city pretty reasonably said, we're going to build another pipeline and bring even more water than they already do from southeast Oklahoma to Oklahoma City. No problem. We own the water storage rights there. We get a permit through the state. No big deal. The tribes stepped in and said, no, this is our water. And they cite this treaty from the early 19th century, the Treaty of Dancing Rabbit Creek, that promised them the water in southeast Oklahoma forever. And so the tribes say, no, you can't just pump this water out of here. We have this treaty, and it's never been gone back on. And it's never been reversed. So they sued the state and the city here, and it went to court. For 5 years, they negotiated over this water in southeast Oklahoma. And at the end of it, the tribes got a lot of what they wanted, which was a seat at the table. They're not necessarily wanting to hoard this water to themselves. They were just tired of being run over and having their resources taken out of that part of the state without consideration. So they were able to get a seat at the table now so that whenever water is potentially sold to Texas, which is another issue, North Texas wants southeast Oklahoma's water, they're going to be able to be involved in those negotiations. They're going to have to be talked to, and their concerns are going to be heard and an important part of those decisions now.
Is the culture of the native tribes in Oklahoma and the general culture of the state more in tune with each other? Are they aware of each other? Is there more intermingling? Does everybody cheer for the Thunder?
Yes. No, that's absolutely right. And the tribes, as they've gained more leadership and influence, they've embraced their culture even more. If you go down to the Sulphur area, to the Chickasaw Nation, Choctaw Nation in southeast Oklahoma, because they have more money now, they're building things, cultural, you know, museums, things like this. The state itself is very proud of its Native American influence and history now. I mean, you look as far as our license plates to see that, or our state flag. We are proud of our culture here in Oklahoma, and we are on the same page when it comes to pride in the state as well and our sports teams.
What's the collision that you worry most about, or that state officials and tribal officials worry about as we think about perhaps climate change changing the water situation to the point where this is going to become a fight?
Well, and I don't want to give the wrong impression here that everybody is happy with this water agreement. There are certainly people in the tribes and even among the leadership that worry about what the impact of this agreement may be one day. We're talking about a couple of lakes in southeast Oklahoma, and most significantly Sardis Lake in southeast Oklahoma, which is very beautiful and a recreational hotspot and a great source of revenue for that part of the state. Well, Oklahoma City is going to have certain rights to that water now. They're going to be able to pump some of it up here. And there is a lot of concern. We just, within the last couple of years, came out of a five-year-long horrible drought here in Oklahoma. And what if that happens again? And what if it happens in eastern Oklahoma? And Oklahoma City needs this water. They're thirsty up here, but Sardis Lake is in a drought situation, and they take some of the water. Well, then you hurt the recreational aspects of that lake. Nobody's going to come out to a dry lake. And so there are provisions in the agreement that say that that's not supposed to happen. But again, it will only be tested when we do get that first big drought. Until then, we won't know exactly for sure how much both sides, you know, the tribes can trust Oklahoma City on this thing. We'll just have to see. But for now, everyone involved in the case says there are limits to how much water we can take in drought situations, and we're not going to drain the lake. But, you know, that will be tested when we get our first big drought.
Logan Layden is a reporter with State Impact Oklahoma. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Despite that large Native population in the state of Oklahoma, there are still huge gaps in access to health care for tribal members. And in a lot of places, care for diseases like diabetes and mental illness is inadequate. Alfreda Dunkeen is a member of the Seminole Nation of Oklahoma, and she remembers what life was like in Oklahoma City in the 60s and 70s when the closest health facility was over 80 miles away. Alfreda's parents and other members of their community started a health clinic in that area, and that turned her into an activist. Alfreda sat down with John Hockenberry this week in Oklahoma City, and she says that taking on a dual role gave her a radical approach to problem solving, helping satisfy the demand for health services in her community while educating people on why those disparities exist in the first place.
We had Community Action Program come in for dental work. We had some employment career educators, and this was in the 60s. We would have powwows to bring money in so that we could pay the water bill, the gas bill at the facility. That it was a diesel garage that we rented. And that little community became, well, the clinic became the American Indian Center.
Would you say a partnership with white culture and Indian culture in Oklahoma with someone like you as the governor would create prosperity for both groups, that working together creates prosperity for the entire state? How would that work?
Oh, I believe so. The American Indians in this state do not get the voice heard oftentimes with the state government. And whenever it comes with the state government, it also filters up to the federal government. And we're minus things. We're minus a lot of opportunities and resources, because it doesn't filter up. And that's one of those things I always wanted to change, is to get people educated, to let people know that we can do things just like anybody else can. But we having our American Indian culture, I think it would be, gosh, profoundly positive to have an American Indian in a state office, such as the governor.
What's your vision of that one people, America? And since we're living in a time when Americans are confronting their history in ways that they haven't really done in decades, how do you see things changing in the next quarter century?
I think that what we're going to have to positively strive with our kids and our grandkids is that we're all a good people, whatever color we are. We don't need to be the ones to stay divisive with the races. And that's been such a problem. It'll be a problem until someone changes it, until we can be one people, like President Trump says.
Does everyone believe that in the Indian community, or are you just the peaceful one?
I'm the peaceful one, actually. Even some of my siblings will say, well, white people did this and white people did that, and maybe we wouldn't be here like this now. But that's gone. You can't go back and change what's happened. You can go forward and make positive change, but you can't go back. You can have that little devil on your shoulder telling you where you came from, what you've been through, but that's not going to change the disparity in health or education or gaming. It's not going to change anything. It's just going to make a bitter person.
Do you see bitterness in the future of the people living on assigned lands in Oklahoma, or more of a sense of peace and accommodation?
In Oklahoma, I believe more peace and accommodation, because we are getting heard more, and it's taken half a century to get heard more. But as there are so many Indians in Oklahoma, we are pulling together, and we are sharing our knowledge and voices with the chiefs, the other tribes, and that's all a positive thing. That's a good positive for the future. And I'm so proud that I'm able to be half Seminole. It's almost to be half Seminole anymore, or half of any tribe, is like a dinosaur.
Alfreda Dunkeen is a member of the Seminole Nation of Oklahoma. She's founder and CEO of the American Indians for Health Quality, and she spoke with John Hockenberry this week in Oklahoma City. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, an American under 25 is killed by gunfire every 70 minutes in this country. But the tragedy doesn't end there. Tens of thousands of youth are injured by gun violence and survive. Our partner station, WLRN, in Miami, Florida, has a new 12-part series. It's called Young Survivors, The Unspoken Trauma of Gun Violence. And it tells the stories of young people who've lived through gun violence, their families, and the others around them. Reporter Nottage Green followed the story of 17-year-old shooting victim Andre Foster, who ran track and played football for his high school team. Then in September, he was one of six young people shot while attending a Sweet 16 party in southwest Miami-Dade in South Florida. Andre was shot in both legs, and he's still unable to talk about the incident. But his mother is Shantae Grant, and she describes the emotional toll that she and her family have gone through since that fall evening when she got the phone call that no parent wants to hear.
Andre called me about 10:33, and he said, "Mom, I've been shot." And I say, "Well, where are you? What do you mean you've been shot?" And he's like, "Yeah, I just got hit." I immediately grabbed my two kids and my husband, and we got in the car, and we were on our way to the home where he was actually shot. Andre called me back about maybe 3 minutes later, and he's like, "Mom, some friends put me in a car, and we're on our way to the hospital." My husband says, "Ask him where he was shot at." And I asked him, I said, "Where were you shot?" He said, "Both of my legs." And immediately, I just kind of like, just had to saw a few, you know, times and pray. And then after that, we got to the hospital. When we got to the hospital, it was like a crime scene. The vehicle that they actually brought Andre to the hospital in was roped off. There was blood everywhere. Unfortunately, he was wearing white pants. So the white pants are, it was blood all over him. When I got into the hospital, Andre was in trauma in the back. About 2 a.m., they told me they were taking him into surgery to repair whatever damages had been done. 3 a.m. rolled past, 4, 5, 6, 6:20 came a.m., and the doctors came out. And they told me that if Andre had waited 5 more minutes, that he probably wouldn't have survived. He hasn't spoke about it. Eventually, I know he will have to. I plan to get him a therapist as well as my other younger children because they also experienced it as well. My 11-year-old looks up to Andre, so of course he wants to do everything that Andre does. And he was actually in the car with us on the way to the hospital. He was hysterical. He was crying. He begged to go in the back to see his brother once we got to the hospital, but of course we couldn't allow him to see Andre like that. Me living in this society with three boys, I do my best to try to make sure my children are safe, to make sure that they have everything that they need, to pretty much try to keep them secure to where they don't have to deal with things of this nature, such as gun violence. But of course, this was a wake-up call because this can happen to anyone. It doesn't matter what we teach them on the inside. It doesn't matter how much we try to guide our children. It's like once they're out of our safety zone, I guess, I'm afraid of what's going to happen to them on the outside. The boys have not been able to go on the park to play. The boys have not been able to go outside and play on the porch. We're just not comfortable with sending our children nowhere but to school at this point. And it's probably going to be like that for a while, but blame me. And I tell Andre and the boys, blame me. It's not you guys. It's me. So definitely this incident has made me, I was already protective, be a little bit more protective in reference to my children.
You've just heard the story of 17-year-old Andre Foster shot in both legs at a party in South Florida. That story told through the eyes of his mother, Shantae Grant. There's very little research on why gun injuries are the second leading cause of death for ages 25 and under in this country, and even less is known about the physical and mental toll of gun injuries on young people who survive them. As part of their reporting on the impact of gun violence, the team at WLRN in Miami interviewed victims and parents, doctors, teachers, and they learned that the consequences like trauma, depression, PTSD, even suicide can plague both the victims and their families long after those gunshot wounds have healed. Reporter Sammy Mack covers health policy for WLRN and is a contributor to that series. She says that what she and her colleagues found surprised them.
Here in Miami-Dade County, we have had a terrible burden of youth gun violence. And we were looking at what happens to these kids. And when we pulled some data from our big local trauma center, which for most of the past decade is the only place a kid with a gunshot wound would have gone, we were shocked to find that there were more than 850 kids who went to the ER with gunshot wounds. And that of those kids, if they made it to the ER, their odds of survival were close to 90%. So there are literally hundreds of kids in Miami who have come of age or are growing up carrying this trauma that we really don't know much about.
You mentioned 850 that you found. I mean, that's just kids who do go to the trauma center. I guess not all do if they're grazed. But across Florida and even nationally, do we know exactly how big this phenomenon is?
There is no registry of what happens to gunshot wound victims. There's nobody who is specifically tracking, particularly if you're looking at long-term effects, the numbers of survivors, the long-term outcomes for them. And so we don't really have a great sense of what this experience is like on a large scale, let alone on a small scale.
We've talked about and reported on this show about the limits of gun violence and gun injury research at a place like the CDC, the National Repository. Is that part of the problem, and is that sort of politicized lack of research into gun violence part of the issue here?
That certainly is what I was hearing from people who do work with kids who have been shot in Miami-Dade County. I spoke with a couple of different researchers and doctors who drew a direct line between the loss of funding 20 years ago into gun-related injury research and the very little that we know about the long-term impacts, particularly on the mental health of kids who do survive. It can take years and potentially millions of dollars to do a really substantive follow study where you're just looking at kids who have survived and what happens to their mental health. That's really complicated research. And so as a result, based on what I was hearing from the people who would like to know more about these kids, who do work with them as much as they can, they don't have a lot of really big studies to go on, and they would love more.
And so in the absence of good public health research and good mental health research, Sammy Mack, you have to turn to the families and to the victims themselves, which is what you've done. And you got a sense here of not only the physical injuries, but the mental and emotional aftermath. What did you find out from the people that you have been talking to about the emotional fallout of being a gunshot victim when you're a kid or a teenager?
There is a lot of indication that these are kids who are set up to struggle. And while they heal from their physical wounds, a lot of them are at higher risk of experiencing things like depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder. I spoke to one psychologist who compared it to what soldiers come back with. You know, the 4th of July being her example, you hear fireworks, and instead of thinking about what an exciting thing that is to see, you're thinking about who just got shot. Like you heard from Shantae Grant in that piece just now, there is a shared anxiety. And when a kid gets shot, it's not just the kid who takes the bullet. It's the family, it's the community, it's the schools, it's where this stuff plays out. There are ripples that go far out from the victim.
So once the wounds heal, at least the physical ones, Sammy Mack, there's the return to life. They go back to school. What happens then?
It sort of depends. It's very case by case with these kids. The school district down here does have a crisis team that will intervene and come in and do some counseling and talk to teachers and kids around the child as well. But that crisis team has to be called in. And we heard from some teachers and some administrators who said that, you know, this is something that we have to deal with so regularly that it doesn't even necessarily make sense to call the crisis team in. And then when you talk to the kids who have gone back, we talked to, you know, one young man who had been paralyzed after being shot. He got a ton of support from the schools, from his friends, from his principal. And even with all of that, he still, 4 years later, struggles with depression.
How does prevention fit into this picture?
Everyone that I spoke to wants to see kids helped survive by preventing the violence in the first place. In the meantime, though, there is this population of kids who are walking around carrying these scars that you can't necessarily see. And there is going to be a generation of these kids. And while we figure out what works in prevention, they need help.
I think, Sammy Mack, as we're talking about these kids, hundreds, if not thousands of them across the country who are victims of gunshots, it just pays to take a minute to realize that we're having this conversation. We talk about the mental health impact of it, the fallout, the public health implications. This conversation by itself has me a little bit rattled.
You know, we hear about kids who die and what the families and communities have to deal with afterwards. You know, homicide numbers don't tell you everything. And this is, I think, one of those stories about the even greater burden of this kind of violence when a child gets shot.
Sammy Mack, health reporter for WLRN in Miami. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Todd.
Who can turn the world on with her smile?
Well, the love is in the air today for Mary Tyler Moore. Remembrances and tributes pour in. Mary Tyler Moore died yesterday at the age of 80. She forever changed television. She presented a new and novel image of the working woman in America.
Mary, Enid gave a great audition.
Yes, she did. Excellent, an excellent audition. Maybe even better than mine.
Oh,
but
no.
I mean, how many times can she go out there and say that?
Say what?
That there's no such thing as a woman's point of view. I mean, that's a cute idea. Really cute, really cute. But what's she going to do the next night?
Besides,
Mr. Grant, I've got the newsroom experience. You know,
yeah.
An audition isn't everything. I mean, she was good. Really, really fine. But I think all the factors considered, I gotta go with me.
That's Mary Tyler Moore in the role that she's best known for, playing Mary Richards on the CBS sitcom The Mary Tyler Moore Show. She produced it along with her second husband in real life. Now, in that show, Mary Tyler Moore played a fiercely independent and outspoken TV producer with both a lot of style and a lot of spunk that foretold a lot of characters on television today. To reflect on the life and legacy of Mary Tyler Moore, we couldn't think of anyone better than Kristen Meinzer, our family member, former producer here on The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast, and Minneapolis native, just like Mary Richards, right?
That's right. Minneapolis pride.
Kristen Meinzer, welcome.
Hi, great to be back.
So a couple of years ago here on The Takeaway, we did a competition online and on air to determine who had been the most impactful TV character in history. You chose Mary Tyler Moore.
I did, and I must say, I won with Mary Tyler Moore's Mary Richards. Mary Richards and Mary Tyler Moore, we're using those interchangeably,
yeah,
and it's hard not to because I think that for a lot of us in America, they were the same person. They were both independent, they were both great business people, they were both strong, and they were both feminists, even if they didn't always use that word to describe themselves.
Well, as I said, you're from Minneapolis yourself, just like Mary Richards, not Mary Tyler Moore. You've got this story. They strangely sort of intersect your path and Mary Richards' path as you sort of traveled around your state and your city. Your life and career almost tracks with hers in a way.
Yeah. In the case of Mary Richards, she was from a small town. She moved to the big city of Minneapolis. She was a TV producer. She did that for about 7 years, and her co-workers were essentially her family, but she also was close friends with all of her neighbors, with her landlady and so on. She wasn't ever married throughout the whole run of the show. And I also was not married in my 20s and 30s. I also worked as a news producer. I also did all the big city things, but instead of going to Minneapolis, I went from Minneapolis to New York City.
Here's Mary Richards as a media television producer. You'll let us know if this reminds us of your life at all, Kristen Meinzer.
WJM feels that television can play a critical role in the control of population growth.
Well, sure it can, as long as they're watching the old tube. They can't make the population grow.
Television has a responsibility.
Get it, Mayor?
Will you shut up, Ted?
Did I just hear Mary tell Ted to shut up on the air?
Yeah. Good.
You know, Kristen, it's hard. It's almost impossible to imagine 30 Rock or Parks and Rec or Murphy Brown or lots of other things that we're used to today without Mary Richards and Mary Tyler Moore.
Yeah, even Tina Fey said that if there was not a Mary Tyler Moore show, there wouldn't be a 30 Rock. She looked at that show as a major influence in her career and how she wrote that show. The finale of Friends was actually based on the structure of the finale of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Oprah Winfrey even said that Mary Tyler Moore Show is the greatest influence in her entire career, which is huge that Oprah would say that. So she was touching on all sorts of generations, all sorts of people's lives, races, backgrounds. And women like me who weren't even really alive when the show was on, still through reruns, still through just living in a post-Mary Richards world, we really got to benefit from that image of a different kind of contemporary woman.
People want to have a little fun. They can go back and watch the old famous opening credits intro of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and then watch the opening credits and the very first pilot episode of 30 Rock when Liz Lemon goes to work for the first time, because you will see the tribute right in the very first opening scene of the first episode of 30 Rock. I noticed that, and I want to point people to that because it's fun. The character of Lori Petry that Mary Tyler Moore played earlier on the Dick Van Dyke Show was far more traditional, sort of the American housewife in the nuclear family where everything was perfect.
In lots of ways, she was traditional, but she also was pushing the boundaries a little bit. Back then, I'm not sure if you've watched many reruns, but she was famous for wearing those cute little black slim fit capri pants, which the advertisers initially were like, oh, we don't really want to see a woman's rear end so prominently. It might be too scandalous. She should be wearing a skirt while she vacuums.
God.
And Mary Tyler Moore pushed back and said, no, I'm going to be wearing trousers because this is what a real American woman wears when she's vacuuming her living room.
The pants were too tight.
They were too sexy. Mary Tyler Moore was too sexy. So she pushed that and America loved it.
I want to go to her film career, not as well known for her movie career, but a famous, famous film, Ordinary People, that Mary Tyler Moore starred in that a lot of people remember her for.
Why did you tell Annie Marshall that Conrad is seeing a psychiatrist?
I don't know. Why not?
Well, for one thing, I don't think people hear that kind of thing very easily.
Come on. For most people, it's a status symbol right up there with going to hear her.
Well, I thought your blurting it out like that was in very bad taste.
I didn't think
not
it was
to
in
mention
bad
a
taste.
Violation of privacy.
Whose privacy?
Our privacy. The family's privacy. I think it is a very private matter.
She is far better known for television, but that film had a big impact on a lot of people too, Kristen.
Yeah, that she won a Golden Globe for that. She was nominated for an Oscar. She was playing a stony, cold, upper-middle-class woman whose son had died and whose surviving son was suicidal. And that was a role that not a lot of people thought of when they thought of Mary Tyler Moore. They think of her as upbeat, as spunky, and she was neither of those things in this movie. And yet she was so respected for it. And it was also Robert Redford's directorial debut, by the way. But she also did a lot of other movies. My favorite movie is actually Flirting with Disaster that she did. And she plays Ben Stiller's mom. And famously in one scene, she lifts up her shirt and shows off how a bra should fit well. It's hilarious. Please see it. Please see it.
Sounds hilarious. You just convinced me. Kristen Meinzer, senior producer at Panoply, now former host of the Movie Date podcast, former producer here on The Takeaway, with a life that loosely tracks Mary Richards from Minneapolis to the big city in big media. Kristen Meinzer, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much, Todd.
Well, we've asked you to share your fond memories of Mary Tyler Moore on our Facebook page, and we've got lots of responses. Karen writes, I loved her comedic timing, how she could make me laugh with just a look, whether it was Laura Petry dealing with her crazy husband, Rob, on the Dick Van Dyke Show, or is Mary reacting to friend Rhoda, or even funnier, Ted Baxter. She was one of a kind, R.I.P. And Maureen writes, as a young girl, I wanted to be Mary Richards. I wanted that cool apartment, her cool slacks and her blouses and her job. To me, when I saw her, I knew it was possible. But when I saw Ordinary People, I was left stunned and awestruck by just how great an actress Mary Tyler Moore really was. How could she be Sweet Mary? I'm very sorry to hear that she's gone. You can add your remembrance for Mary Tyler Moore on our Facebook page at facebook.com/thetakeaway. That's what you do. And we always want to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today. This is The Takeaway. You
PRI, Public Radio International.